customers worldwide. On the web at ecolab.com.
6 minutes now past 11. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Well, Minnesota legislators are back at the state capitol today trying to finish their work and go home for the year. And they do have lots of work left to do. Thus far, there is no agreement on the major bills on this year's agenda, taxes, education, transportation, capital improvements. So far, legislators have not even been able to agree on just how much money the state can afford to spend on permanent tax cuts or new spending programs. And the clock is ticking. Under the Constitution, legislators can only meet for 9 more days and floor sessions, and then they have to go home. So lots of work to do, not too much time left to do it, and Governor Jesse Ventura has joined us this hour to talk about his priorities for these last few days of the legislative session, what he'd like to see legislators focus on. As always, we invite you to join our conversation. If you've got a question for Governor Ventura, give us a call here. Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Governor, thanks for coming in today.
Hi, Gary. You threw me a curveball. Here I thought we were going to come in and discuss the Timberwolves' chances at Portland Wednesday night and how they do in the playoffs. I'm just kidding.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Now, it looks like they could use a little heft in the middle. Are you going to suit up?
No, but I think it'll be a great series. You know, they had an opportunity to win on Sunday, and they kind of choked in the fourth quarter. I think they got out physical. Portland played a little more physical than they did in the game, and I think the Timberwolves will come back tomorrow night with a more physical outlook. I think you're going to see a rougher game.
But that's where you'd come in.
So. No. I'm just a fan. That's all I am. My days of playing anything are over.
Well, are you going to the Senate potluck lunch this noon?
No, I'll be running on the treadmill, or as I call it, rat running. When you run on the treadmill, it makes you feel like one of those little rats inside the cages that the kids have sometimes in school and that. So I call it rat running.
The whole process does seem to be kind of at a standstill right at the moment. Is there any reason for Minnesotans to believe that that the deadlock will be broken?
Well, first of all, Gary, I think Minnesotans shouldn't panic because we do have a biannual budget. Government is not going to shut down. The budget that we worked on last year, last session, will carry us all the way through till next January, and it should carry us through. The thing that this session is about is capital bonding, and that's the focus that I think it should remain at, and the focus that if they do their bonding, they can get out of here and go home. But the problem that arises is you have something this November that comes up, which is called an election. So you're going to get a lot of election year politics that go on over there because legislators, of course, feel that they need to get reelected to come back. You have the natural power struggle between the Democratic and Republican parties of who will have control of the House, who will have control of the Senate, who's trying to get control of the House and trying to get control of the Senate. So it ends up very political in a year where really if they'd simply focus on capital bonding, they could have been in and out of here and gone home already and been home for Easter and stayed home for that matter. But they get into a lot of stuff. And I'll just say this. Last year, we had the largest tax rebate in the history of the United States. We had the largest income tax cut in the United States. And we had the most public school investment in Minnesota in over the last decade or more. If I couldn't get reelected on those three issues alone, I wouldn't run again. Mm-hmm. Because that's how important those three major issues are. So they're really, what you have is a lot of people that are frightened that somehow they're not going to get reelected, frightened that somehow they're going to lose the power. So they're off on all these other tangents of taxing and spending and all this stuff. But I want to tell Minnesotans to rest assured that if they come to no agreement on anything, government's not going to shut down. We have a biannual budget that we will stick to until next session.
But surely not all legislators are acting purely out of interest getting reelected, and politicians like to get reelected naturally, but I would think that a good many of them are firmly committed to the policy positions that they've taken. Don't you believe that?
Oh, I believe that, sure. But on budgetary issues, how come we don't keep them separate? You know, if we agree to a biannual budget last year, biannual means every 2 years. Why do we then come back and try to micromanage it in the odd year? You know, let's stick with the budget that we've agreed on and go from there. And there's also what was passed last year is the trigger mechanism that if there is indeed a budget surplus at June the 30th, not of this year, but of June the 30th of next year, all surplus money goes back to the people that put it in, back to the taxpayers.
Now, last year, at about this same time, it looked kind of hopeless up there. And finally, you got together, I believe it was with the House Speaker Slagham, and announcement came out that you had decided to go along with the House plan on the across-the-board tax cuts, mm-hmm. and then the log jam was broken and everything kind of fell into place. Can we look for the same kind of process this time where eventually you sit down behind closed doors with the legislative leadership, work out something, and it all gets taken care of?
I wouldn't necessarily think so, only on bonding, because my focus, again, is on bonding. Bring me a bonding bill. That's what they're here to do. Capital bonding. Mm-hmm. And I will be happy to sit down and try to negotiate or leverage a bonding bill, because that's what this session is supposed to be all about. As far as the other topics go, hey, we've gotten a lot of the important ones out of the way, Gary. You can fish with lighted lures now. You can get logs out of the bottom of rivers and lakes. You can salvage logs if you desire to. You can have, in fact, you talked about it at the top of the hour. You can now have those potluck lunches and get-togethers, church gatherings and all that, and you don't need any permit from the state, but we're hoping that you people out there take responsibility now. There's a lot on your shoulders. When you dig into that hot dish, you're on your own. So we've gotten a lot of important things done over there so far, don't you think?
I want to just ask you one more question here before we get to some callers. You know, callers are building up already.
Now,
you know, it's the way this has been characterized, the deadlock, is that the fundamental issue has to do with how much money is actually available for permanent tax cuts, permanent spending programs.
Yep.
And your finance department has said $549 million is available. Senate DFL goes along with that figure. The House Republicans have argued for a larger figure, but apparently they've winnowed their position down now to, I think, $571 million. Well, you're only $22 million apart. Why not just say, okay, that's fine, and let's go with that? Because it's all kind of a guess anyway, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's not a science. It's not an exact science. But we have for 50 years or more, government, all governors and legislators have gone on the forecast of the economic advisors, Tom Stinson and his group. And I have all the faith in the world that they do the best job. They're certainly more qualified than any elected official over there to determine what a forecast is. And what they're forecasting here is actually for the year around 2003. That's what we're forecasting for. Now, the simple matter is you have to agree upon a number. You have to get on the same playing field. Before you can do anything else, you have to be on the same field. And my view is that you accept the numbers that the forecasters give you. Governor Carlson always did. Governor Perpich always did. The last governor who didn't was Governor Quay. And if you remember, he got in some serious trouble. Mm-hmm. Because he did not go with the forecasters. And my view is, if you're going to err on the side of caution. Mm-hmm. That's my view. So as soon as an agreement can be reached on those numbers, then from whatever they negotiate, whether it be tax cuts or spending, is up to them. I lean more towards tax cuts rather than the spending side. So I'd prefer, but before we can do any of that work, we have to agree on what playing field we're on, or otherwise it's all irrelevant. So we'll see what happens this week and whether they can agree on the number. And if they do, then it'll be full bore ahead, I hope, and they'll get the job done.
Might you suggest to your finance commissioner that she take another look at those numbers and add them up a little differently, perhaps?
No, that's not a good idea because then you know, if you're just allowed to grab a number out of the air to make the other numbers work, That's a bad habit to get into. You don't try to pick a number so that it'll work on the spending side and the tax cut side so that they can then negotiate and have enough to negotiate with. That would be a policy I would never support. I will pick my number out first and go with Tom Stinson and his group. And Tom told me if I didn't follow his numbers, he told me unequivocally he'd quit. And I don't think the state needs to lose him.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour. If you've got a question for the governor, give us a call here, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. First caller is from St. Paul. John, go ahead, please.
Good morning. Jesse, how are we coming on the license standard one figure for all the cars? And I'll hang up.
Well, thank you. Well, not too good, because I was told that there was a lot of support for it, but that I'd get the credit for it, so it'll never happen. So, you know, that's what you have to deal with is politics over there. I think it's the right thing to do. I think there's a lot of people that agree it's the right thing to do, but it's a question of who gets the credit for it, and it's kind of synonymous now with my name. So even if I took a backseat role on it, people would still attribute it to me. I think it's a great day. Actually, dollar for dollar, more Minnesota under $100,000 income would benefit from a flat $75 car license tab fee than they would with the current income tax cuts that the House is proposing for $100,000 or less, because I call it the 13th car payment. You know, Minnesota is very unique in that aspect that we have, you generally make 12 car payments a year on your automobile. Well, here in Minnesota, we require a 13th car payment, which your tabs are usually bigger than your car payment.
Mm-hmm. License tabs aside, you said a few minutes ago that if you had to choose, you'd rather the legislature go with tax cuts rather than more spending programs. What form would you like to see those tax cuts in? Again, license plates aside.
Well, I haven't really considered it. I guess, you know, the House is proposing more income tax cuts across the board there. That would be the logical place to do it. I would prefer to keep the money on account in the property tax account and let us do some meaningful property tax relief next year.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned that if indeed a permanent tax cut is passed this year, permanent spending increases are approved this year, that it's going to limit your flexibility next year in putting together a new two-year budget?
It will. It certainly will limit the flexibility on it. It'll box you into a corner with what I think could be very rash decisions made at the 11th hour this session, rather than allowing us the flexibility to really put together a biannual budget that, with meaningful property tax reform. You know, the property tax system is in such disarray, and Matt Smith, my head of revenue, has been studying it and working on it, and he's coming forward with proposals to me in June or July. And if they do all the things they say they're going to do this session, it's going to limit what we'll be able to do. We'll be able to implement some of it, but it could end up more of the old typical Band-Aid approach that you have on property taxes. All they do is apply Band-Aids to it, and that's not a permanent fix to the system, and it's a very complex system that really I don't believe should be that complex. Do you understand yours, Gary, when you get it? You know, when you get that big sheet at home and you start looking at it, do you understand it? It's okay to admit it. I admit I don't. You know, I can pick the thing up and look at it, and I run to Matt Smith with it and say, Matt, what is this all about here? Because that's how the thing is. I don't think an average homeowner can look at their property tax statement and unequivocally say they understand it from top to bottom. And I don't believe it should be that way. I think that the taxing should be far more simple than that.
That being the case, why not encourage the legislators, if they're determined to pass some kind of permanent tax relief this year, to focus that money on the property tax rather than the income tax?
Well, I have encouraged it, but then again, it's an election year. See, many of them feel that they need to do something so that they can get reelected. You know, that's election year politics. It's one of the detriments that we have. It's one of the reasons I support so fully unicameral and four-year terms. Because when you have these two-year terms, elected officials every other year have to start running for re-election again, and then their minds get warped because they can't concentrate on doing the right thing necessarily. They have to concentrate on what do I need to do to get reelected.
Al, your question for the governor?
Good afternoon, Governor. First of all, I'll start out letting you know that I did vote for you, but there's a couple of things I'm a little disappointed on. When I was doing a little research into voting for you, I didn't do any research into your opinions and plans on your transportation issues, I guess you might say. And I've been kind of disappointed in the way you've been leading. I've been watching for the last 25 years the legislature taking no lead whatsoever and whining about the governor not leading on getting our road system upgraded, and I've watched it decay, and I've watched nothing basically happen. I know you were a breath of fresh air, and I was expecting you to come in and make some changes, but God, you sure did. But I'm not really happy with what I saw.
Why? What aren't you happy with?
Well, I've been seeing you pushing transportation as opposed, transit as opposed to fixing the road systems. We're the only system in the country that's got a two-lane beltway. I'm out here in Eden Prairie. I've lived here my whole life and seen it go from pretty good commute on the Southern Strip to stop and go. I hear talk about, first of all, Crosstown continuing a one-lane ramp. No talk about enlarging the system, which is necessary to try and take care of the influx of people. Mm-hmm. I know you want to get people into buses and such. It's great, but, do it.
My transportation package is multimodal. It isn't one over the other. And, in fact, I'm the only one. First of all, if you checked on my background, you'll find that I supported light rail back in 1990 when I was mayor of Brooklyn Park. So I haven't changed my position. I believe that looking into the future and looking 20 years down the road from now, that we are going to have rail systems, that we are going to have to use rail. We're going to have to get more like the Europeans and provide rail as well as bus and give people transportation choices. I'm as much a car person as everyone else. I mean, I love to drive my car, and I realize the congestion is horrible. If you look at the package that I've put together, I've allocated funds long into the future right now that will provide a transportation mechanism and funding rather than one-time money. What you're getting out of the legislature right now is one-time throw money, $400 and some million at transportation, which is going to solve nothing. What I've advocated is taking the tax that you pay on automobiles, the sales tax, and dedicating all of that money towards transportation funding from now and long into the future decades ahead, so that we have a constant source of dedicated transportation money that will go for roads. They will go for rail, they will go for bus, they will go for park and rides, everything. But the main focus naturally will be roads, because most people drive cars. That's the thing that I'm focusing on right now, is providing that funding. The legislature this year is one-time money, and then prepare yourself, because I hear a lot of rumors they're going to come back next year and want to raise the gas tax. To raise that money. My proposal right now will fund transportation without raising taxes at all, because it'll simply shift over the money that we pay on automobile. The purchase price tax will go all dedicated to transportation.
Governor, how do you address the what seems to be kind of an underlying concern that a good many people have, that whenever you or anybody talks about money for transit, there is a concern that really what's being said is, we are going to drag you out of your car, whether you like it or not, and long-term transit advocates hate cars, they hate the gasoline combustion engine, and we're going to stop this once and for all.
Not at all. I mean, if that were the case, why would I own two Porsches?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a fairly prevalent attitude, though, among other
transit? I think it's a misattitude, if you want to call that. I'm not opposed to car drivers at all. What I would like is to be given choices. I would love to have, up where I live in Maple Grove, I would love to have a rail system, so when it comes time to go to a Timberwolf game, I can leave my car in the garage or take it to a park and ride, jump on a rail, and get dropped off at the Target Center. I wouldn't have to pay those high fees to park downtown then for the game. I wouldn't get stuck in the parking ramp when the game's over. You ever been in the ramp lately at a Timberwolf game and seen how long you sit there? You spend 15 minutes on that circle thing just to get out on the road, because it's so stuffed and parked in there. What we're talking about, I'm not anti-car at all. I've owned cars my whole life. The first car I ever owned was a 64 GTO muscle car, 350 horsepower, a rompin', stompin' Pontiac. I love cars. But the point is, at certain times, I would like the opportunity to be able to make a choice. If I don't want to take my car, there should be alternatives out there, especially in a metro area, that people, viable alternatives that people people can use. When I used to work for Ted Turner down in Atlanta, I would fly in there and I'd use the rail, and it was remarkable. It was unbelievable, better than getting a taxi cab, adding to that congestive traffic down there in Atlanta just to get to and from work at the CNN Center, when I could jump on the rail and it would drop me a block from the building, and it was far cheaper, and it kept me from hiring a cab and adding to the congestion out there.
Mm-hmm. Brian, your question for the governor?
Right. This is kind of a wish. First, I want to say I voted for you, and I think you're a great governor, but I would wish very much that you'd make as your highest priority to pay off the state debt and not have a bonding issue. I bought a house about 2.5 years ago on an 11.5-year mortgage, and I like the fact I'm already paying much more principal than interest on the payments.
Yeah, well, the problem there is that if you pay for things in cash, then you have one-time taxpayers footing the whole bill for projects that are going to last many, many years. Philosophically, that's why you bond. You bond because say you're going to build a building. Well, you don't want to lump the entire payment of that building onto 1 year's taxpayers or 2 years of taxpayers. You want to spread that out over 25 or 30 years because you know the life of that building is probably going to be 50 years. And I just don't think it's right that 1 or 2 years taxpayers should have to pay for the entire capital bonding project. That's why you bond. But what I'm trying to eliminate are these pork projects, these local projects. For many, many years here in Minnesota, it's been bring home the pork. I know when I was mayor of Brooklyn Park, whenever you needed something done in the city, the first option you took was, well, let's get our state legislator to put it on the state bonding bill, and we'll let the state pay for something that is exclusive only to Brooklyn Park. Well, last year, the legislature passed a law stating that anything we bond must have a statewide significance to it. Well, I held their feet to the fire on that this year. I said, wait a minute, stuff that comes in to me that does not have a statewide significance is not going to get bonded. It'll have to be bonded or dealt with at the local level, and I'm holding them to that, and I think that that's only fair. It's far too long. You know, we had the big glitch in 1998 where they bonded nearly $1 billion or over $1 billion. Our traditional bonding has only been between $400 and $500 million, and that's what I got us back to on my proposal this year. But people need to remember that bonding, you do have to pay for it eventually, and it's like Christmas. Remember when you were a kid and you gave your list to mom and dad of everything you wanted for Christmas? How often did you get the whole list? Not very often. Why? Because mom and dad couldn't afford it all. They got you what they felt was the priority, what the best presents they could afford and give to you were, and we need to deal with bonding the same way. What is a priority? What takes significance the most to the most people in Minnesota? And those are the projects we bond. But as for paying for everything in cash, that's an unfair way to do it, I think, when you're going to have a building that's going to last 35 or 40 years or longer.
There's a school of thought that says that one thing that should be done with the bonding bill, and I suppose other parts of the budget as well, is to look longer term, that there's some concern that Minnesota might lose its competitive edge long term, and as a consequence we should put more money into the U of M and the Minsky system and so on, and with an idea of developing new industries, new businesses in Minnesota. Are you flexible in that area?
Would
you be willing to put some more money into?
Well, in fact, what I did, Gary, on my bonding was I left that up to them. I told them, give me a priority list. You give me the list of what you deem to be the most priority of what you need done, both in Minsky and the University of Minnesota, and we went off their list of the one they listed as number one, number two, number three, number four, and we went down to where we thought it was fair for this year's bonding. Now, naturally, we couldn't fulfill the whole list and do everything that they wanted, but there'll be bonding bills further down the line a few years from now that maybe those can be addressed. But we allowed them to make their list up and allowed them to dictate to us what their priorities were, because I feel they know more about that than we do. You know, so I encourage their participation in that.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour. He's come by today to talk about his priorities here as the legislative session draws to a close in St. Paul. If you'd like to join our conversation, let me give you the number, but don't call because all our lines are busy. You'll just get frustrated. But try us in a few minutes. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to some more callers in a couple of minutes.
I'm Juan Williams. On Thursday, April 27th, Talk of the Nation will be in Minneapolis. Youth is the focus of this month's Changing Face of America series. We'll be talking about the new generation of Americans that some are calling the millennials and looking at the growing support for gay students in high school. Join us April 27th from 1 till 3 at Washburn High School or listen on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW-FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
Programming in NPR is supported by the Midwest Mountaineering Outdoor Adventure Expo this Friday through Sunday, featuring 120 outdoor presentations and exhibitors. Outdoor adventure planning available at MidwestMTN.com. News headlines now. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Good morning, Gary. U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno is on Capitol Hill today to answer some of her critics about the armed seizure of Ilian Gonzalez. Senators she's meeting with include some who've been harshly critical of the government's action. Cuban Americans in Miami are protesting the seizure of Ilian Gonzalez with a one-day general strike. Businesses in Little Havana, where Ilian had been staying with relatives, are closed, and the streets this morning are nearly deserted. Police in Washington, D.C. are still looking for the gunman involved in yesterday's shooting at the National Zoo. Seven children were wounded in the gunfire, including one 11-year-old who's said to be brain dead. Police are investigating whether the attack was gang-related. They say they're looking for only one shooter and that they know who he is. The NAACP has posted a $25,000 reward. The zoo remains closed today. People on both sides of the abortion issue are at the U.S. Supreme Court today. The court is taking up a controversial Nebraska abortion law. The justices are hearing arguments on whether the state law banning so-called partial birth abortions should be allowed to stand. In regional news, St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman has signed a resolution renaming a popular recreational roadway after retiring U.S. Representative Bruce Vento. The Burlington Northern Trail in St. Paul will be renamed the Bruce Vento Regional Trail in honor of the 4th District Congressman. The section of paved trail makes its way through St. Paul's east side where Vento grew up. Vento is retiring from his seat so he can concentrate on battling lung cancer. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for sunshine in the east, partly cloudy skies in the west. There is a small chance of showers in west central Minnesota this afternoon. High temperatures today ranging from 68 to 75 degrees. At this hour, mostly fair skies reported throughout the region. Duluth reports fair skies in 55 degrees. It's fair in Rochester in 60. St. Cloud reports fair skies in 63. And in the Twin Cities, fair skies, a temperature of 61 degrees. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
All right, thanks, Greta. 27 minutes before noon, this is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio, and our guest this hour, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, who's come by today to talk about his priorities for the Minnesota legislative session, which is drawing to a close. Constitutionally, legislators only have 9 more days where they can hold floor sessions before they have to go home, and under any circumstance, they have to leave by, I believe it's May 22nd is the official date.
And let me add, Gary, if I might, there'll be no special session.
Under any circumstance?
There's no circumstance I can, other than a national emergency. Now, you know, if Mother Nature were to hit and strike with devastating tornadoes or something like that, and we needed something on that order, that, of course, is different. But there's no reason with the time they've been there. In fact, the legislature came in early and said they were going to get out before Easter, and lo and behold, they haven't. So there's no feasible excuse that I see of why they couldn't get their work done.
Mm-hmm. Prudy, your question for the governor?
Thank you for taking my call. And I have two comments, Governor Ventura. Number one, I want to thank you for vetoing the bill on driving in the right lane on interstate.
You mean the left lane?
The left lane.
Yeah, the left
lane. I just thought that was a very, very poor bill. And I appreciate you living out in Alexandria. I appreciate you vetoing that bill because we come into the city quite often. And my second comment, Governor, being a common sense person, I just don't understand how come we taxpayers have to send our money into the city, into St. Paul, and then have it sent back. When I pay a bill, Governor, I don't overpay the bill so they can send me a check back. I just don't get it.
Well, what it comes down to is that, you know, we have tax systems set up that is going to bring revenue in. And when you've had an economy like we've had, I assume she's talking about the surplus.
Right. And the need for a permanent tax cut.
Right. Right. And the problem is we've gone through in the United States of America here the last 10 years, the most bull economy in the history of the land. No one could predict it. No one has predicted the level in which this economy would stay as bull as it has, where people are working at higher income jobs. They're spending more money. You're bringing more in through sales tax, through income tax, and through the other tax mechanisms that we have. And no one knows when it will end, but rest assured that it will and might. And so it's a case that if we adjust too much and the economy takes a turn the other direction, well, then you could face a deficit. Then you could face, and then you're faced with very difficult decisions of what do we cut out of government if there's a deficit? What does government not provide for anymore if there's a deficit? And people need to remember, too, that the majority of the state budget goes towards salaries and things of that nature. And a lot of those are dealing with union negotiations. So when a state budget goes up every year, it's because a great deal of it is based upon the fact you've negotiated with unions. It's salary increases that have been done through collective bargaining negotiations. And you can't very well go back on your word once you've reached an agreement on a collective bargaining situation. And so, you know, there's a lot goes into it, and I'm just very pleased that we have the trigger mechanism in place, that if we have overtaxed you, that you will get your tax rebate back and a tax-free check every other year for sure. And if the legislature deems it, there should be another one this year because we still have a surplus left over. But the other thing to remember, too, is a great deal of this money is projected. It's projected surplus. The money is not currently there in the bank. So when you see the figures that are thrown out by the media, oh, there's going to be $1.4 billion surplus, that's a projection. That money is not there. That's what they're projecting will be there a couple years from now. If it indeed is there, I'm happy to give it back. That's why the trigger mechanism is in place. If the economy does turn, that projection may not happen. And all that money may not be there. So don't fall victim to the misleading media all the time, and don't fall victim to projections, because they are simply that. And I always love to say...
Now, Governor, I'm going to interrupt you.
All right.
Because this is a... Now, you always blame the media.
No, I don't.
Yes,
the media reports it.
Well, now that's a different thing. Why is it that... Now, in that instance again, now people hear you talk about, I don't get bogged down on this, mm-hmm. but people hear you talk about that, and you're a very popular guy, and they say, well, yeah, see, it's the media. They're responsible for this.
No, they're not. But they report on it, and they don't always thoroughly report it. They don't report everything. They throw headlines out. They throw sound bites out that only report a portion of what the reality really is. You know, they need to report on the entire situation, not just a soundbite, not just what'll draw listeners and make money, you know, for the evening news like that. And so people need to understand that these are strictly projections, that they're not money in the bank, and that when it becomes money in the bank, we'll deal with it. But we will deal with the projections, too, in our own manner. But again, if I'm going to err, I'm going to err on the side of caution rather than. And it would be easy, Gary. I could sit here right now. And I could give the biggest tax cuts in Minnesota history. I could just say, hey, why should I worry about a structured budget being fiscally structured 4 to 5 years out from now? I could do 1 year's term, do everything I wanted to do, and ride off into the sunset. And all I can say is the next person that would sit in my chair would face the repercussions of those decisions. I will not do that. I think that I'm in place here to be a conscience. I'm in place to be fiscally conservative, but to also take an attitude that I want to leave with a structurally balanced budget that was as good when I came in from Governor Carlson. I want to leave it to the next governor in that same form. But it would be simple for me to do that. I really could. I could do it and just cut everything, carve the government up, do this, do that, and ride off into the sunset. And, I, maybe if you run, you'd come in the chair, Gary, and you'd sit back and go, what did Governor Ventura leave me with?
Ken, your question, please.
Yes. I'd like to know, as a working, well, I was working. I just recently lost my job because I can't afford housing. I'm a single parent, and I'm not calling to ask them to feel sorry for me. I'm calling to find out, if anything, what is being done.
That's a great question. I'll tell you what I'm doing on it. I've proposed that we have what we call TANF money that comes to us from the federal government, which is specifically designed to be used to help low-income people such as yourself, a working person, a single parent, and things of that nature to help them get on their feet, help them become a good part of society. They want to succeed. They don't want to sit at home and collect welfare. They're working parents. I've dedicated $83 million towards low-income housing. That's how strong I feel about it. We want to create a public-private partnership with Habitat for Humanity, which is an organization out there that gets donations from the private sector. We want to help from the public sector, and they get great results, Gary. Because, and I believe, I'll tell you why, because the person that's going to own that house actually helps build it. And I think that creates a bond between the person and that structure to where there's just an underlying feeling of belonging that this is my home and I'm going to take care of it because I sweated, I toiled that helped build this home. And so part of my money will go to Habitat for Humanity if the legislature will approve it. And I think that housing is so vital because housing is one thing that you can put one-time money into. It doesn't have tails. You can build so much housing, and it won't come back to where you have to continue to supplement it 2, 3, 5, 10 years down the road. And by doing that, it also creates stability. When you have, like the last caller who lost his job, now, if he has permanent housing, it's much easier for him to go out and get another job knowing where he lives, that he's going to remain there, that he doesn't have to move every 3 months. And think what it does for the kids. You know, we got a lot of kids that fall through the cracks. They're not succeeding in our educational system, and it keeps coming back to me time and time again that much of the problem is because these kids are being forced to change schools every 2 to 3 months because their living situation is such they have nothing stable in their lives. Now think back to when you and I went to school. Stability was a thing that kept me being a good student if I was one in school. Because of the fact I grew up in the same neighborhood, my folks lived in the same house for the entire 18 years that I was under their roof and the entire 13 years that I went to school. That is important. And if you've got kids out there that are having to change homes, change districts, change schools every 2 to 3 months, how can we possibly think they're going to be successful in school? So housing's extremely important. Stability in one's life is extremely important to being successful.
Back to the phones. Monica's on the line with a question for the governor. Monica?
Hi, and thanks so much for taking my call. Jesse, I just love you. I am so impressed with your administration. I admire you for your open affection for your wife, for your openness of just enjoying life, and for your appointments. I think Mondale was a coup, and I was so sorry you couldn't get Steve Mann, and that Joe Bagnoli is wonderful. Most important...
You're not Joe's wife, are you?
No.
Okay, just checking.
And I like light rail, and just go for it. But my question is, I know you've been trying hard to get unicameral, and I'm wondering if it would be an adequate compromise for you to either have the legislatures be a full-on volunteer position or to just reduce the number of the legislatures that serve. And I'll hang up.
Well, there's plenty of options. The main reason that I've been so supportive of unicameral is I believe the people deserve the right to make a choice at what their government's going to be. And I'm really saddened that we have 201 legislators over there who don't feel like I do, that I have all the confidence in the world in the people of Minnesota. I think that we're extremely bright. I think that this would be a tremendous education that would take place this summer if they would merely put it on the ballot. If bicameral wins, so be it. I'll live with it. No problem. I'm going through my second bicameral legislation right now. But the point is what could happen is so much more involvement by the public of getting actively involved in what their government is. And I've traveled throughout the state, and I'll ask large groups of people, how many understand the bicameral system right now? You'll be lucky if you get 2 or 3 hands go up in a crowd of 400. Now, to me, that is very detrimental when you have a public out there that doesn't even understand how their government runs. And if they put unicameral on the ballot, then an education process will take place this summer. You'll have bicameral people out educating the public on the bicameral system. You'll have unicameral people out educating people on the unicameral system. You will have an excited public that not only will there be a presidential election this fall, they will get to actively participate and determine what Minnesota state government will be. And I truly believe you could see a 75% to 80% voter turnout if that were to happen. And you know what, Gary? If that happens, we all win. Because no matter who would prevail, bicameral or unicameral, you would have a much smarter public, a much more informed public, and you would have a public that felt engaged with their government again. And it's just sad, so sad, that these legislature people don't have the courage to put it out there. I have the courage. I'm willing to, and if I were a bicameral supporter, and I had one legislator from who was from Bloomington, I forget his name off the top of my head now, met with me. He said, "Governor, I support bicameral." But he said, but I also support the people having the right to make this choice, and I commend him for that. You don't have to be a unicameral supporter to support putting this on the ballot. You have to be, I think, a people and a Minnesota supporter to put it on the ballot.
You're going to put the arm on legislators anymore on the unicameral issue? You've got a meeting tomorrow, breakfast meeting with the House Republicans.
Well, I'm just going to encourage them to have the courage to do it. If they so choose not to, well, then they may pay the price November at the elections. Because I'll tell you, I personally, if I were not the governor and simply a voter, I would be offended that they felt that I didn't have, that they didn't have enough trust in me to choose what my government would be. And that I don't have the right to make that choice because it's a constitutional issue. And so I would carry it over at the ballot box later.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to make any trades on this versus something else legislators want?
I don't trade on anything. You'll find that that's the misperception, if you want to call it, that has gone on over there. Business as usual has always been you trade this for that. My administration, I don't trade anything for anything. Each thing stands on its own merits, and I'm not going to say, yes, I'll give you unicameral if you'll give me this. No, I won't do that at all. If unicameral ends up not being put out there on the ballot, I keep my integrity by not swapping it for something else that I maybe don't support. I'm a firm believer that everything stands on its own merits and should, and one thing doesn't cross over to another. That's old-time politics, and I don't think I was elected to bring old-time politics back to the table.
Bob, your question for the governor?
Thank you. It's a privilege to talk to you, Governor. I voted for you. I'm very pleased with my vote. I'm very pleased with your administration so far.
Thanks, Bob.
I'm going to risk making a fool of myself. This bill that I want to bring up has been sailing through, but it hasn't been getting a lot of media coverage. And for all I know, it's already gone up or down someplace else. But it's the baby dump bill. And it's the bill that makes it legal for a person to drop off a baby at a hospital with no questions asked and no penalties. And I understand that the people who wrote this bill were very concerned about the welfare of children, and I agree with that concern. But I'm just concerned that this bill is too simple an answer. I'm always suspicious of simple answers, and I'm afraid it's encouraging irresponsibility, and it's going to be abused by people who are going to coerce young girls to drop off children they might otherwise keep. I just am urging you, if that bill has yet to cross your desk, Please veto that bill.
Well, again, it's a tough decision to make, and I think it's a decision that you have to look at. To me, the small child is the ultimate choice in that decision, because this baby doesn't have a choice. This baby isn't old enough to give an opinion at all. And if the baby has already been conceived and is a life out there, I believe very strongly that it is our position, or my position, that life needs to be saved. And you realize that, sure, there's going to be abuses to anything like that. But ultimately, would you really, if a mother was willing to drop off her child at a hospital, never to see it again, would you really want that person raising the child anyway? That's the question too to ask yourself. And is there love? Because to me, how could one, if they truly love that child, drop it off like that? And I would want the child to receive love. So it is simplistic, but again, it's a case of I would rather have the child dropped off at a hospital facility than left in the lavatory of a a gas station or in a garbage can and things of that nature. When you've heard about tragedies like that, I think that it's much more in the best interest of the child to have it put in a safe place to where it can receive medical attention and care and love that it needs if that does happen, and rather than the alternative.
Let's get at least one more caller on here before we wrap up. Corinne?
Hi, I'm glad to talk to you. I had a couple comments for the governor. I voted for him. I appreciate his honesty. And I also want you to know that I'm a retired Air Force nurse and a current public health nurse in Rice County. I had other things to talk about, but I agree with your comments on this last caller and the baby bill, you know, just from my point of view and the job. Also, I liked your decision on this last abortion bill. I know that was a tough decision for you to make, but I agree that politics and the government should stay out of some of these decisions that need to be made between a woman and her doctor. And my last comment that I have for you today is concerning prostitutes and so forth, because this issue often comes up. And my feeling on this is that if there weren't clients going to the prostitutes, we wouldn't have to be dealing with issues in their department either. So I'll hang up and wait for your comments, and it's good to talk to you.
Thank you. I'll only comment on the last one, and that is it'll never go away, I don't believe. So, you know, if you pick up the Bible, you're going to read about it. If you pick up every, it's they don't call it the oldest living profession for nothing. And certainly you wish that it didn't exist. You wish that there was ways that, people's behavior, that they would make the right decisions. But again, I don't think it's government's job always to step into individual behavior and determine that. As I've always said, you can't legislate stupidity. You know, people are going to do stupid things, and every time someone does something stupid, you can't expect us to go pass a law to make a stupid decision illegal.
That fella from Nevada was out here saying that Minnesota should launch a study into legalizing or at least decriminalizing prostitution. Agree?
Well, I don't see where you put them in jail. I don't understand where it would be a jailable offense. You know, I say you put violent criminals in jail. Mm-hmm. You know, that should take a priority over what is considered consensual crime, which I believe is crime against yourself. You know, if you commit a crime against yourself, I don't think government has the right to imprison you for harming yourself.
Corinne raised the abortion issue, and that did cause quite a stir. Do you wish, in retrospect, you had never gotten involved, had your staff get involved in negotiations?
Not at all. Not at all. I commend my staff for the courage it showed, for looking and attempting to deal with it. What I'd like to do, if I may, I think this answers it better than I ever could, and I carry this in my wallet now. And this was written by a young lady named Anna Becker from Irondale High School in New Brighton, and she said, "I am a high school student taking an advanced placement course in government and politics, and I am responding to three bitter opinions printed April 18th on Governor Jesse Ventura's veto of the Woman's Right to Know bill. With my understanding of governmental dynamics, I say the veto was ethically sound and showed the highest respect for his office by observing the limitations that our government should work within. Although averse to the idea of abortion, I recognize that it is not the government's job to regulate this extremely private issue in anyone's life. Likewise, the government should not dictate when you may have children, divorce your spouse, or even donate your organs. People must take responsibility for themselves. The government cannot force anyone to be morally correct or ethical. Our system was designed to protect basic rights, but not force us to be angels. What the supporters of the bill have advocated is the abuse of government power. Yes, it is abuse, even when you believe it is for a good cause. Cloaked in self-righteousness and rooted in narrow-mindedness, the governor should be appreciated for his tactful handling of this particular situation, and it shows he read his job description. High school senior.
Governor, we're out of time, but I sure appreciate your coming by today. Can we count on a tax rebate yet?
I hope so. I'm on board for it and have been for a long time, Gary. Hopefully in July you'll get a check, I hope.
Thanks for coming by. Have a good swim.
My
or
pleasure.
Run on that treadmill.
Okay, thanks.
Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura joining us for this first hour of our midday program. 5 minutes now before 12 o'clock.
Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 25th of April, 2000. It's the birthday of novelist Paget Powell in Gainesville, Florida, 1952. His first book was A Disto, came out in 1984, a story of a 12-year-old boy growing up in a backwater section on the coast of South Carolina. Paget Powell, who said, "My interest remains with those who fail deliberately and those who can't help it." It's the birthday of the New York Times correspondent J. Anthony Lucas, born in New York City, 1933. He wrote the book Don't Shoot, We Are Your Children, about the counterculture of the late 60s, and Common Ground, a turbulent decade in the lives of three American families, which looked at families affected by court-ordered busing in the Boston public schools. It's the birthday of blues guitarist Albert King, Indianola, Mississippi, 1923. He was left-handed and taught himself how to play a right-handed guitar upside down by pulling the strings down, which led to a style that influenced many other musicians. He was one of 13 children, made his first record in 1953 called Bad Luck Blues, later joined Stax Records in Memphis, where he released Born Under a Bad Sign. It's the birthday of Edward R. Murrow, born in Greensboro, North Carolina, 1908, grew up in Blanchard in the state of Washington. After college, went to work for the CBS radio network and was sent to Europe as European director, where he gave eyewitness reports of Hitler's arrival in Vienna and the Battle of Britain. It's the birthday of another great figure in radio history, Guglielmo Marconi, born in Rome, 1874. In 1900, he filed his patent for improvements in apparatus for wireless telegraphy, and a year later succeeded in receiving signals from England at his station at St. John's, Newfoundland. It was the beginning of the expansion of radio communications and broadcasting. It's the birthday of poet Walter de la Mare, born in Charlton in Kent, England, 1873. It was on this day in 1816 Lord Byron left England for exile in Europe amid rumors about his relationship with his half-sister and his bisexuality. And it's the birthday of Oliver Cromwell, born in Huntingdon, in Huntingdonshire, England, in 1599, who led the parliamentary forces during the English Civil War to overthrow the Stuart monarchy and became Lord Protector of England from 1653 to 1658 during the Republican era. He was a Calvinist, but he was a Calvinist who believed in religious toleration, and as Lord Protector, he permitted all Christians to practice their own religion, Catholics and Protestants. He loved music, was known to smoke, liked sherry and small beer, and permitted dancing at the marriage of his youngest daughter. Here's a poem for April the 25th, entitled April 25th, California, by Tom Clark. Sweet taste of honey in the warmth of morn, cumulus flotillas scud across the sun, eucalyptus still in shades, all black, but at its zenith. There's this white luster where a westerly stirs it, I guess. Lovely to be born and live here to have seen it. A poem by Tom Clark, April 25th, California, from his collection Easter Sunday, published by Coffee House Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, April 25th, made possible by 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers will find more than 10 million used, rare, and antiquarian books on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Technical direction by Tom Mudge and Leszek Wojcik and Scott Rivard. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.
It's 12 noon. This is Midday coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. Gary Acton here. Glad you could join us today. We have news headlines next, and then we're going to continue our coverage this week, marking the 25th anniversary of the end of the war. Right now, let's break for station identification.
Revisiting Vietnam, 2 one-hour specials looking at the legacy of the Vietnam War in the U.S. and Vietnam. Wednesday and Thursday at noon on Midday on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. We have a fair sky. It's 61 degrees at KNOW FM 91.1, Minneapolis.